We intend to look at the book of Habakkuk, or Habakkuk as some people pronounce it, Habakkuk. And this gentleman was living at the time of Jeremiah, round about, contemporary of Jeremiah. And the period of Josiah and Joachim, because Josiah was a good king, but died as he went to try and hold back the armies that were coming up from Egypt, thing perhaps he should never have done. And he found himself in a position where, much to the dismay of all the people, there was a kind of a letdown, it appeared, to the folk from God, because God obviously had already ordained judgment upon the people. And Habakkuk, therefore, is speaking into a situation which requires a certain amount of reappraisal and re-understanding, especially after the time of Isaiah, when in the days of Hezekiah the people had been delivered by a supernatural intervention by God from the troops that were surrounding the city of Jerusalem. It's therefore a very difficult thing, say 150 years later, or 100 years later really, this period will be, to actually be willing to say, well, God won't intervene this time because we've gone too far. That's very hard for the people to accept. That was Jeremiah's message. And of course when it did happen, it was even harder again to come to terms with it and to reinterpret your theology and start to see why it is this has happened. And therefore Habakkuk has something along that line to say to us. Of course, the famous verse that comes out of this reinterpretation of the situation is the first, the just shall live by faith, or the just shall live by his faith, or even the just shall live by his faithfulness. Faith and faithfulness are very close to one another, biblically speaking. In fact, the word faithfulness is more often translated by pistis than anything else in the Old Testament, more than belief or anything along those lines. It's important for us to remember that when we see how the New Testament is using the word faith. So the faith that he is speaking about in Habakkuk is the sort of faith which is fundamental to any man's approach to God. And it is taken up by the Apostle Paul, and it's quoted 3 times in the New Testament by Paul, by the writer to the Hebrews, and of course by James. These 3 places use the phrase somewhat differently. We're going to look at it in its original context, i.e. the book, 3 chapters of the book of Habakkuk. But it's worth noting that in the Roman epistle, which you remember is very strong on being right with God, on righteousness, on justification by faith, okay? In the Roman epistle, Paul uses it in the 1st chapter, quoting it to justify his view of faith as being a necessity for Israel and for anybody else for that matter, and the ground upon which God is able to receive a person, when he says, and the just shall live by faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. That is to explain his assertion. It's important to notice this, perhaps if you've got Romans chapter 1 verses 17 and 18 in front of you, or 16 and 17 in front of you, you'll see it's important. The first thing then is that Paul is saying, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God, for salvation. To the Jew first and also to the Greek, as it is written, or to everyone that believes, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now it's quite clear, as Paul is going on to explain in the whole epistle, why he has quoted this verse, because it has the word just, and he's going to talk about being justified. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So in order to line up something from the Old Testament to justify his view on justification, to justify his view on righteousness, to justify his view on being just or right before God, he quotes Habakkuk, the just, the righteous shall live by faith. Secondly, in order to show that the righteousness is by faith, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, the Jew first and also to the Gentile and to the Greek, for as it is written, for the, therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. The just shall live by faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So the second word that is important to Paul there is the word faith, because he is saying that righteousness is by faith, a righteousness of God which is by faith and from faith to faith. So he's got two of the words that he's after in that passage. He's got the word righteous, just, same word of course. He's got the word faith. That's pretty straightforward. The just shall live by his faith, for is from faith to faith, a righteousness of God which is by faith. Alright? However, the third word that he's trying to prove from this text is not the word life, which we would have, salvation, which we would have thought it was, because he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God for salvation. But really it should have read, for life. Because the verse he uses now is going to say, for the just shall live by faith. He really needed a verse that said, the just shall be saved by faith, didn't he? To get all his three major words that he wants to prove from his assertion concerning the gospel. But in actual fact, as we will see even from the context of Habakkuk itself, the word life and the word saved are very close to one another in the Hebrew. In fact, in the Aramaic, they are the same word. Okay? And in Romans chapter 5, Paul is going to say, we shall be saved in or by his life. So life and salvation and life are virtually equivalents in the New Testament writings. So I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God for life, or it's the power of God for salvation, and to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness, the justice, the rightness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but it's not written quite the same way, but yes it is, if we realize that salvation and life are equivalents. The just shall live by faith, okay? So the first use of this word from Habakkuk not only shows us life and salvation are closely related together, as this epistle would demonstrate, or this epistle, this minor prophet will demonstrate, and as Paul proves or uses in Romans, but also he is underlining, as he does right the way through the epistle of the Romans, the necessity to be right with God in order to get life. In other words, if that's a bit of jigsaw and that's a bit of jigsaw and they won't fit, there is no way in which the life of one bit of jigsaw will flow into the other. Unless I can fit into God, I cannot get his life. Okay? In order to tap into God's life, in order to be saved in his life, I have got to be in a right relationship with him. Just as a plug has got to be in a right relationship with the socket if it's going to pick up the power, the electricity. So justification is a means to an end. It isn't the end itself. Justification is putting the right plug on so you can get into the socket and you can receive power for salvation, for life. The end that God is after in our lives is life. The end is salvation, to be saved in his life. To have a life conformed to the image of his Son. It's life that we need, power of life. But as an incidental en route to get that power, we need to be put right, justified, slotted in, socketed in order to pick up that power. Now, generally speaking, I know it's an overstatement of the case, but Reformed theology has spent virtually all its energy and effort to keep talking about how you get right and get right and get right, but it is not spoken about the end of getting right, which is to receive life. Consequently, we spend a lot of time in cerebral activity understanding the mechanics. In other words, whether it's a three-pronged plug or whether it's a two-pronged plug or whatever, to understand the mechanics of that as to how we can fit into God, rather than actually drawing and receiving the life that comes from God, which is the purpose of righteousness. But anyway, even if we've understood that there could be an overbalance on the matter, Romans is going to be very strong on how you're put right in order to receive life. So when Paul uses this verse from the book of Habakkuk, it's as though he says it like this: the just shall live by faith. Nobody else can live by faith but the just, because nobody else can get slotted in. Now that's the emphasis in Romans. Are you still with me? So the second place is in Galatians. I said James, didn't I? It's Galatians. And in Galatians, the epistle there is not so much as to how you get plugged in, because you're supposed to be plugged in already, or know how it fits. You who had Jesus Christ so evidently set forth before you, how you bewitched and moved away from the gospel, etc., etc. And what Paul is doing in Galatians when he talks about justification is with a view to showing that if you get put right by God at the beginning of your Christian life, you've got to stay put right if you're going to go on living the Christian life. Now again, can you see what happens, if I can just be a little bit overly general, if we spend all our time on cerebral activity of how to get right with God, what righteousness and justification is, which Reformed theology does an awful lot with, if we spend all that time, then having got it in our minds how you get put right, it's a three-pronged plug, not a two or whatever, the next issue is, how then do I live the Christian life? Well, you see, if I don't actually really put that plug in, what I have to do from then onwards is walk around with a loose plug on the end of a wire saying, now I am going to live because God has done so much to give me a three-point plug. God has done so much to make me righteous, I'm really going to live for Him. We try by works to live for God. Sanctification by works is the almost inevitable corollary of overemphasizing Reformed teaching of justification by faith, followed by sanctification by works. That's why Paul, in Romans 3, if he speaks about justification by faith, it isn't because he doesn't think they don't know that they know anything about it. He knows that they know all about it. It's because he says, if you start that way, that's the way you continue. If you're justified by faith, that's the way you go on in faith. It is the principle of justification by faith which enables you to be sanctified, because it's by faith. Got it? So in Galatians, where we're told to stand fast in the liberty, not the works, but the freedom, wherewith Christ has made you free, and that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, goodness, temperance, meekness, faith, etc. The emphasis in Galatians is not like Romans to show us how to get put right, but it's how to tell us to stay right so that we become like Jesus, so that we live. So when Paul writes Galatians, he says, the just, by faith, shall live. Because what he's saying is, if you're going to do any living, you've got to go on believing. And so the Galatian epistle, which was the famous Lutheran one, so I guess he got a bit of life. Galatians was the great Lutheran epistle. Yes, you can chuckle. Eric knows all about Luther and the Lutheran church. But if you've, it is interesting historically to read that classic. I don't think it's the last word on Galatians, but it's certainly worth reading. Luther on the book of Galatians. Well, quite clearly that's where he expresses his soul as to what he's discovered, and it's very fine. So really the emphasis there is how we actually go on believing, living. I think I would put it that way around. When you get to Hebrews, there's always a question in Galatians and Hebrews. When you get to Hebrews, at the end of chapter 10, it quotes this verse for the third time, and it says in Hebrews, and we will go on, we will not draw back, or at least we are not those who draw back to the losing of the soul, but we are those who press on. Why? For the just shall live by faith. End of chapter 10 of Hebrews. And although we then run into chapter 11, which is full of faith, I'd like to suggest that although it's full of faith, the emphasis this time is much more upon not drawing back unto lostness, unto perdition, if you've got the King James Version. We are not those who are drawing back by unbelief to perdition, but we're those who are pressing on to the saving or the keeping of the soul. That is to do with life. And although it's followed by this great passage of 11th chapter, which is generally thought of being a great catalogue of men who live by faith, and certainly it is, I think it's the fact that they live by faith that's important. And it's the life of not drawing back that Hebrews is emphasizing. So roughly what we've got, obviously with certain qualifications, Romans, it's the just shall live by faith. Galatians, it's the just shall live by faith. That's how you get holy, that's how you live, that's your sanctification, by faith. And in chapter 10 of Hebrews, it is the just shall live. We're not going to draw back to the losing the soul by faith. Okay? So quite an important verse from this minor prophet, a of only merely 3 chapters. 2 chapters if you let the higher critics get to work on him, because they want to cut off the last chapter, which is in itself a complete unit in as a psalm. It's a psalm, Habakkuk. But I hope you'll see by the time I've finished, not only is this the justification for understanding life and salvation as to being equivalents, because salvation is very prominent in the psalm, but also the whole psalm becomes almost meaningless without some vindication at the end, as this psalm indicates. So, now perhaps we're ready to have a look a little bit at the structure of it. In the first part, which is chapters 1 and 2, there is a burden upon upon Habakkuk, and he comes up with 2 complaints. So you can see in part 1 I've got there, chapter 1 verses 2 to 4, Habakkuk's first complaint. The complaint is, why doesn't God punish his people? Second part, which is part 3 there, Habakkuk's second complaint. How can God use an unholy instrument? Because God answers and tells him that he's going to punish his people. And he said, well, how can you punish them with people who are worse than we are? And how can you use an unholy instrument? And he gets an answer to that. There are a couple of other verses there which are quoted in the New Testament. One in verse 5, that's quoted in Acts 13:8. The whole of chapter 2, verses 4 and 5 are actually quoted in Hebrews 10:37, where it says, tarry and it will come, it will not delay, etc., etc. So there are a couple of places which are quoted in the New Testament. I've indicated those for you. Then, having got 2 answers, including the famous answer, the just shall live by faith, there are 5 woes on the oppressor who is the instrument in God's hand punishing Judah. And then comes the final, not so much proscript, but the answer in prayer of Habakkuk to God, although it's a psalm, it's also a prayer, chapter 3. And there he expresses his desire for revival and ultimately for salvation. And we're going to see how that is absolutely essential for us in understanding the whole of the book. So let's open, if we haven't done it yet, in the first chapter of Habakkuk. The first question, running from verse 1 through to verse 4, is basically, why doesn't God punish his people because of the state they're in? The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. O Lord, how long will I cry and you will not hear, and cry out to you for the violence and you will not save? Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold the perverseness? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up and strife and contention. Therefore the law is slacked, and judgment does never go forth. For the wicked compass the righteous, and wrong judgment proceeds. Now that is the state of Israel in the days of, well, not so much Josiah, but Jehoiakim, after Josiah's death, when his son took over and began to lead the people very badly. And that was the state of the country. Now the answer of God is, I am going to judge Israel. Verse 5. Behold, you among the nations, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I work a work in your days, which will not be believed, though it's told you. Now you remember, from your notes anyway, in Acts chapter 13, that is the verse that Paul quotes in the synagogue to the Jews when they reject the message of the Messiah, Jesus. So he's just saying the same thing that happened in the days of Habakkuk is happening to you, unbelievers. God is working a work which will make the nations amazed. And they will say this is a wonderful or a marvelous and incredible thing. And you will not believe it, though it's told you. Now it's a work of judgment. Verse 6. Why? What is this particular problem that is arising? I will raise up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, that bitter and hasty nation, and they shall march through the breadth of the land to possess it, and the dwelling places are theirs, they're terrible, dreadful, their judgment, their dignity shall proceed from themselves, their horses are swifter, etc., etc., and you get this description of the armies of the people of Babylon. Verse 11, Then shall his mind change, and they shall pass over, and shall become guilty. This his power unto his God is rather strange in the King James. It's far better to translate, I don't know what your translations have got, for their might is their God. Is that right? Might is right. Their might is their God. So the Babylonians basically were serving the God that most people serve in the end. Might is right. And therefore, they are the instrument that God will use on the people. He goes on to explain more of that in the rest of that chapter. So, of course, Habakkuk has a problem. How is it, well, he's starting in verse 12, how is it that God can use such an unholy bunch as this people of the Babylonians? Verse 12, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Lord. You have ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, you have established them for correction. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil, so how on earth can you use them to judge us? That's what he's implying. And you cannot look on iniquity, wherefore do you look upon them that deal treacherously, and hide your peace, when the wicked are swallowing up men that are more righteous than he? So although the Jews may not be up to much, there are some amongst them that are pretty righteous, and they're being swallowed up by the Babylonians. And you make men as fishes of the sea, as creeping things that have no ruler over them. And they, that is the Chaldeans, or the Chaldean himself, the ruler, Nebuchadnezzar, takes them all up with a hook, with an angle. And they catch them in their net, and they gather them in the drag, and therefore they rejoice and are glad. And they sacrifice to their net. That's an evidence of might is right, because might is their God. Here they are, worshipping the net, the instrument of their power. They worship the war machine. And he's complaining about this. Because by them their portion is fat and their meat plenteous. That's because it's by serving the God of might, it's by serving the war machine that they've got enough to eat, and they've been raping the societies around them so that they've got very easy lives. Shall they not therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations? They won't cease destroying the nations as they keep devouring. So, quite truly and clearly, the Babylonian instrument is a very bad one, very cruel nation, and therefore Habakkuk wants to know what God's got to say about that. We've got the classic position here, I think, or illustration, of how the covenant, when it is corporately abandoned, leaves individuals exposed to receive as victims and as innocents the judgment of God. I suppose you get it slightly again in the sins being visited, the iniquities being visited upon the children to the fourth generation. That is, innocent victims receiving the response of God in their lives because of their parents. Now, we know it's pretty obvious if a parent goes bankrupt, the kid suffers. Or if a parent goes evil and beats everybody and beats his kids, then the children suffer. So they receive, if you like, the consequences of their sin. That is true in families, it is true on the wider basis of localities, it's true according to nations. Now, what is it with the special nation of Israel when the whole nation is in a covenant relationship with God? Well, it seems as though, and it's difficult to know, to judge when, there are certain points whereby God either gives up the nation and the covenant, and whereby he doesn't, according to a proportion that is outside our knowledge. You get it in an illustration with Sodom, that if 10 righteous men could have been found in Sodom, then that town would have still been here today, says Jesus in his day at least. But he couldn't get 10. If there could be 10 righteous men in Israel, could God have kept the covenant going with Israel? The answer is we don't know what the actual figure is at any point. God couldn't go on with Israel with just one Achan, and presumably his family, in the camp. At other times he seems to put up with a vast apostasy as long as he can secure 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So he still puts up with them for a while. So how God continues in covenant relationship with the people once one person is defecting is entirely up to him. But there does become a point when you pass the Rubicon, and then God, as it were, gives the whole lot up. And then the righteous suffer with the unrighteous. Then the promises don't seem to function. for the individual, because they're not functioning for the mass, for the total. And the promises you remember from Exodus include the promise not only of taking away all sickness and disease, and at times there were lepers in Israel, but God was healing them outside. Not only that their bread and their water would be blessed, and there were times of famine, of course, that came and hit the whole land, whereas there were other areas round about, like the widow of Sarepta, who had some food left. Not only are there times when the promises concerning being barren, and the promise of everyone, nobody being childless, and there no miscarrying, that should have been the nation as a whole, but God still puts up with it, and they're not barren until a certain point arises. All these things are sort of coming and going in Israel's history. But in particular, there is the one that says, then the nations would flee before them. That one would chase 100, is it, or 1,000, and two would chase 10,000. But the armies, the enemies, are not fleeing now before Israel. So presumably the covenant has gone into redundancy. And therefore, righteous people who are left over are suffering, like Habakkuk. He himself is clearly a righteous man. But he is suffering the consequences of a corporate apostasy. And that is very largely what happens when churches are on the move and when they're not. Either a church of an area, or an individual church, a church of an area, or a church of a nationality, church of of Europe, but it's some geographical boundary that you can only claim it within those boundaries to the degree at which there is a corporate commitment to the covenant, and then God is committed to it. Otherwise, there are periods in church history where all you've got is a long trail of individual overcomers who are just about magnificently and supremely keeping the testimony going. What we expect to see in the end days is those individual overcomers breaking through so that everybody gets blessed, and that we're back in covenant relationships with God. And therefore, because these individual spiritual giants are raised up and kept going by God throughout church history, they, in a sense, are not the norm. They are the abnormal situation. And yet they do exemplify the basic groundwork of what it means either for an individual or for a whole people to be right with God, and that is by faith. And that's why Habakkuk comes out into the open here is so importantly. Whereas the mass of the people are apostatizing, here is one of the giants of faith who's keeping the whole business going, so that at least God, maybe with another generation, can corporately function again. And so it is in the church age too. The church in Europe very clearly is apostate. And God has taken his hand off, and there's very little that in power happens. But there are individual pockets where people are still standing out on the basis of the just shall live by faith, which is the answer that God's going to give Habakkuk. We may say there are precious few churches in this country that are really standing their ground corporately. But there are individuals who are pressing on and standing that ground and bringing blessing to others. What we're concerned about is in Ichthus that we stand in a corporate relationship, covenant relationship to God. And that then we can bless other churches too, and they will stand with us. And then in London, we can stand in a corporate relationship with God. Not just magnificent heroes standing on their own against the tide. They go down in church history, and we all admire them, and they're wonderful. But they, in the end, don't change, ultimately, the overall advance. How is it that the people are being overrun? Supposing, for instance, we were the church in Russia, and we'd been overrun by the Bolsheviks. Or the church in Germany were overrun by the Nazis. As individuals now, God calls upon us to act like Habakkuk. And look for the day when there can be recovery on a mass scale, but at the moment we've got to stand and put our heels in as individuals. And the result, of course, as you've seen, certainly in Russia, there has been a terrific response in the church. That's because there have been men like Habakkuk who've stood their ground, and now possibly we'll see such a breakthrough in the church in Russia and China and so on, that we can say that those nations will be blessed, whereas Britain and others are not, because we're not there yet. They'll be blessed because there are 10 righteous men. There are more than 10. There are those who are committed in covenant to God and God to them. So the message to Habakkuk is a vitally important one in every generation of the Christian church, and certainly an important one for us today. So what is the response? Chapter 2, verse 1. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon a tower, and I will look abroad, or look forth to see what he will say to me. and what his answer shall be when I am to my complaint, concerning my complaint. So he's given us his complaint in two parts in chapter 1. It's the second part that really is in view, that needs a good answer to it. How can you use an unholy instrument, and where are we going to get to from here, and what about me? Am I going to be judged with the wicked? And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision, make it plain upon the tables, that he that may run that reads it. In other words, make it big and plain and set it up so that everybody can get the message and do something about it. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. But at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come, and it will not tarry forever and ever and ever, is what's implied. Then the answer comes. That is just, again, an indication of how it's necessary for at times to wait on God to get an answer. And in the confidence that it will come. I've waited half an hour, I haven't got an answer. Well, faith says I'll wait 31 minutes, there will be an answer. It doesn't give up. And that is what Habakkuk is doing here. He's expressing already the kind of faith that he has in God. As some people say, well, I've asked God for 30 minutes concerning my problem. What is it? Well, maybe it's something like, why do the wicked get away with it and and those who are godly always suffer? And I haven't got an answer, so I give up and I'll call God evil and that God sent this upon me, or I'll treat him like, you know, that this is the will of the Lord or something like that, rather than standing our ground until we hear from God. Faith says God is good. God doesn't do these sort of things. God doesn't beat me up when I'm seeking to love him and serve him. He doesn't chasten me for his own pleasure kind of thing in the wrong ways. And it, like Job, it says I'm going to stand my ground. If God's like that, then he's not worth serving. If God's like that, I'd rather join the other side. And in the end, he comes out with an answer, because he will not denigrate the character of God like some theologians do, because he tarries and waits. Now you can see there's an element of faith there, because it believes that God is going to answer. You see? Unbelief then finds a rationale as to why he didn't answer that way, or why he answered in that particular way, why my baby sister died, or whatever it was, you know, that many people carry around in them as their big complaint against God. Well, they've interpreted or justified in the kind of character that God could have done something about it, or he should have done something about it, or that God did it himself, or whatever it was. And all that has actually given up waiting and standing in faith to hear from the Lord. Now Habakkuk says, I'm not going to do that. And that's why he's such a giant of faith. He doesn't say, well, we're all sinners anyway, so why shouldn't God beat us up? He didn't say, well, I must be a worse sinner than those Chaldeans. Or like the Job could have said, I must be a worse sinner than the theologians who are telling me off. He just wouldn't give in on that ground. He said, God's character is not like that. Because he had to stand by what he knew was true. And consequently, ultimately, there is a breakthrough. Now, the break is verse 4. Behold, his soul is puffed up. Lifted up, puffed up. That's pride. It is not straight in him. Now, that is important for understanding the latter half of verse 4, which is our crucial text. It's important to see that the answer concerning the Chaldeans, and indeed other people who deserve judgment, is that ultimately an analysis of their character and of their experience and their situation is their soul is just a bucket of wind. There is nothing in it. It's blown up, it's puffed up, it's empty of any substance whatsoever. Their soul is puffed up. It is not right. It is twisted. It isn't right within him. Okay? Now, that in itself is the seed of judgment that will judge the apparently victorious sinner. The sinner who seems to be getting away with it. Already, he is not getting away with it. He's got an empty, puffed up soul, and it is twisted. It's not right within him. What then is the suffering saint? And what is his compensation? His compensation is, but the just shall live by faith. If you have faith, then you will not be empty inside, neither will you be twisted. You will be just, that is straight inside, not twisted, and you will be full of life. Now, at first sight, that seems a thorough pietistic answer. And to begin with, it is. And it's got to be. The pietistic answer in suffering is, yes, everybody is being bombed and splattered and murdered and raped as the armies sweep through the city, but the man who is straight inside, misused as he may be, the man who has life inside him by faith, because he's got faith in God, has got far more already than the empty windbag of a twisted soul who's already got the seeds of judgment within him. That is the first part of the answer. The just shall live by faith. Now, of course, if in the end that kind of life is not victorious and vindicated so that it overcomes death, and it seemed to overcome death, it wouldn't really be very much, well, it would be an answer, and some people stoically have stood in on that when they've not even been sure of the second. So it is an answer. Because my present experience, despite my victimization and innocent suffering, my present experience of the life of God within me by faith and being right with him is far more fulfilling and satisfying than all the advantages that can be gained by an ungodly, empty life that is twisted. That is the first answer. And that is what lies behind Paul's use of it in Romans. It's what lies behind any Christian. Whether we've been healed or we haven't, whether we've been delivered or we haven't, whether we've lived a long life and been satisfied with a long life, as Proverbs suggests, or we haven't, isn't the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is, the just shall live by faith. That's the man who's really alive, whereas the other man is utterly empty. You don't have to scrape a sinner for very long before you hear him echoing inside in his emptiness. That is true. It is pretense at first that the world has it good and they're full up with so many wonderful things and utterly satisfied, but you don't have to go very far before you discover that people are empty, utterly inside, and the seeds of judgment through sinning are already at work within them. That is the profound answer that starts to come through to Habakkuk. In a moment, we're going to see that he stands in on that and expects salvation to be expressed on an even wider and greater level, just as we do. If I'm just about to be martyred, I live in the hope of the future, because I know the life that's in me belongs to the future life, therefore I expect to participate in the New Jerusalem. And that's a part of it, but I wouldn't expect to participate in the New Jerusalem if I didn't have that life already within me. So it isn't pie in the sky, get ready to die. It isn't you've got nothing to lose but your chains kind of idea. Therefore, you know, because it's we already have got within us the down payment, the element of that kind of life that must succeed. It would be better if in this life also we could stand together in covenant and see the promises that you will have no famine, that your enemies wouldn't overrun you, that you, etc., etc., that not one of you will miscarry or be barren, that I will take all sickness and disease for you. It would be better, because that is another phase of the expression of the life that I'm already beginning to enjoy inside, now beginning to express outside in corporate experience. And what has been rediscovered in the whole restoration kind of scene is that in covenant relationship together, we can anticipate far better than we ever thought we could, together, what's going to come in the ultimate future in the perfect society. But that doesn't mean to say it's not going to be contended. It doesn't mean to say the devil doesn't fight against it. It doesn't mean to say he tries to break that relationship of covenant. That's why when people begin to move and work together, he's forever trying to get in his disunity. Because that is going to mean that there may be, yeah, a few heroic saints that will go to heaven. Maybe all of us would be. But if we're broken up and disunified, then we cannot experience outwardly the good blessings that we already know. We've got the down payment inwardly. The just shall live. We've got that life. But we want that life to be expressed outwardly too, which was being judged and wasn't happening in the days of Habakkuk. Okay? Make sense? So the five woes that then occur in the rest of chapter 2 are really a description of the empty windbag soul. The soul that's just an empty puff of wind. He is puffed up, literally. It's full of verse 5 is sort of a more general statement. Yes, moreover, because he transgresses with wine, he's treacherous with wine, he's a proud man, doesn't keep at home, he doesn't stay in Babylon, he spreads abroad, he enlarges his desire as hell and as death. In other words, they can't be satisfied. So the more he eats up and gathers to him the nations and heaps unto him all the peoples, the more he keeps gathering in more and more of the nations around Babylon, the less he's satisfied. That's an evidence, you see, of this empty soul. Then verse 6 to verse 8, oppression and conquest. Verse 9 to 11, self-assertion and covetousness. 15 to 17, it's to do with inhumanity to his neighbor. And finally, there's idolatry in verses 18 to 20. Verse 18 to 20 we'll read. What profits the graven image that the maker makes that has graven it? It's a molten image, a teacher of lies that makes his work makes the work trust therein, trust in idols, dumb idols. Woe to him, and what's the point of his religion? It's so empty, it's full of dumbness, he doesn't get anything from it. Behold, it's laid over with gold and silver, there's no breath in the midst of it, no spirit in it. No spirit in it, it's interesting. Ruach is there, it's for use for the Holy Spirit. Verse 20, but the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. So Habakkuk goes back at the end of that list of woes to assert confidently for himself and for others who will trust that God is at home in his temple, and that's God's purpose for his people. He wants to get them back there. So if he's at home in his temple, it's quite natural that chapter 3, a prayer of Habakkuk, should be at this point put before us. And that's because it's as though he is presenting his prayer to God in communion. Now this passage itself is a very deep one, I don't want to go into it all in detail, but you know it's the famous one where the word revive comes, which is very rare in the Bible, so revival doctrine has to go back to Habakkuk chapter 3. O Lord, I have heard your report, and I was afraid, and O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years, make it in wrath, remember mercy. In other words, when the judgment of God was falling on Jerusalem and upon Israel, he calls upon God to remember his loving kindness, which lies within his covenant, of course. And this is what God so often does do. This is what I think the revival will be in our own country. It'll be in the midst of judgment. There are signs, perhaps, that there's a Habakkuk kind of people are beginning to appear, a few individuals here and there. But the ultimate result is that in judgment he will remember mercy, because there are men like Habakkuk who have sought the Lord. And they break through and bring that blessing upon the people. There's lots of descriptions from the Exodus, from the conquest, from Judges and so on, to describe how God is functioning and working when he rises and stirs himself up and comes to his people. So this time isn't so much judgment and faith that keeps you going through it, but it's judgment and is there a salvation in the midst of that judgment. The important, perhaps summing up of this chapter, would be seen in verse 16 onwards. When I heard of God's coming towards them, moving towards them, my body, my belly trembled, my lips quivered at the voice, rottenness entered into my bones, I trembled in myself. So obviously the effect of God's movement is having a terrific impact on him. And when people worry about people's eyelids flickering or trembling or just mildly going red around the neck, don't worry too much. People who have experienced God's movement in the past have known a lot more outstanding and dramatic things than that. And here is poor old Habakkuk saying his belly trembles. That'd be an interesting spiritual manifestation. His lips quivered, rottenness entered his bones, he felt he couldn't hold him up. I trembled in myself, where he stood, and so on. So he's obviously affected by the presence of the Lord. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall the fruit be in the vines, the labour of the olive shall fail, and the fields shall yield no meat, the flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls, yet will I rejoice in the Lord. Now, in a sense, on the basis of the covenant, he shouldn't. But on the basis of the covenant, all those things were promised to him. That there wouldn't be famine, that their cattle would increase, etc. But it's not happening, but he's still saying, yet I will rejoice, even though these things don't happen. Why? I'll rejoice in the Lord, and I will joy in the God of my salvation. So recovery begins by joying in God. But it doesn't mean to say, therefore, that Habakkuk is not interested in salvation, in the sense that he doesn't want to get back to where those promises are actually being fulfilled. You follow me? When we use this as a kind of, well, you know, we can go on trusting God through suffering, and well, I've been so disadvantaged in living for him, but I'll stick it out because, you know, All that does is glorify man. It does not glorify God. He's saying, God's a pretty hard taskmaster, but look how marvellous I am. I put up with it and still go on serving him. There's nothing that glorifies God in that. And I think there's a very subtle element that I would just warn you of. I don't want to be unnecessarily ruthless about certain people and ideas and books and things. But there is a self-glorification in that kind of martyrdom spirit that says it sticks it out. It's more like the Nordic gods, where you don't know whether you'll win, you probably won't win, you're probably going to lose, but you're still going to stand on the side of the right kind of idea. That is only true if, in the end, the side you're standing on is so right that it's also moral, and it will vindicate you. It is not right to stand on the side of so-called right that will not do that. If the universe is immoral, then God's immoral. If there isn't an ultimate justification, then it's not worth standing on that side of God, and it isn't right to, in actual fact. There's got to be a justification that love has got its own dividends, that truth will always in the end prevail, that light will always overcome darkness, so that in the end God does keep his promises, and that there is seen to be that God ultimately is victor. Okay? Otherwise, if evil will always triumph over good, then we're in an immoral universe, and God making it that way is immoral himself. Got the message? So beware of that kind of almost self-glorification or human glorification. Yeah, and what I reckon we've got here, though, is I'll rejoice in the Lord when I haven't got anything else. Why? Because he is the God of my salvation, and salvation itself is what we wait for. It may be we won't see as much salvation in this present life as we'd like. Let's go for as much as we can get. But there will be a day when our salvation draws near, and when ultimately salvation will dominate the earth, when our bodies too will be saved. And it's because we believe that God is just and fair and therefore righteous with that promise that we think he's worth serving. Okay? So it's not to be read as though I'll put up with anything because I'll join God of my inward salvation because I'll never get anything outward. It's I will join God because he is my salvation. And that means not only the saving of the spirit, not only the saving of the soul, but it's the same word used, of course, as you know full well, many times in the New Testament for saving the body. When it says that the elders are to anoint with oil, it's that they may be saved. They may be healed, saved. It's the word sadza. So the word salvation is used for all elements in the salvation of relationships and the salvation of society. Now that's the God we're joining in. The Lord is my strength. He will make my feet like hinds feet and make me to walk upon the high places. And that is, of course, the Habakkuk is going right up into the heavenly places, seated in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, enjoying, as it were, looking down on all the chaos, but knowing that God is going to be vindicated and that his salvation will come. Because we're enjoying it in spirit doesn't mean to say we're not interested in body. It's because we're enjoying it in spirit that we believe in that God who will vindicate it in body. So really this is looking forward into the future, and it's showing how man stands when he's got nothing left but God. It doesn't mean that he's going to stand there forever. It means he expects that the day will come when he stands there with God in the salvation that God supplies. Just one other little technical point which I threw in at the end. I think as salvation in verses 8, 13 and 18 is the word Jeshua. So you could read 3:8 as, was the Lord displeased against the rivers, your anger against the rivers, was your wrath against the sea? Did you ride your horses and your chariots of Jesus? And then verse 13, he went forth with Jesus, Jeshua, for the people, and with Jesus of your Christ. A way of translating verse 13, you went forth with, not just for, but with, no definite article, straight on to Jeshua, with Jesus, Jeshua. So God went forth with Jesus. Of thy people is all right, because Jesus was of Israel, but it's possibly translating that preposition for your people. For Jesus, salvation, for Jesus, of or with your anointed, your Christ. So you've got Jesus Christ there. Jesus of your Christ, or Jesus of your anointed. And then verse 18, yet will I rejoice in the Lord, I will join the God of my Christ. Oh, sorry, the God of my Jesus. God of my salvation. All right. You remember the Jew who says that the name of Jesus doesn't occur in the Old Testament, therefore how can Jesus be the Messiah, etc., etc.? Well, you point into a few verses like this, say the word Jesus all over the Old Testament. It's all over it. But there are some outstanding places like this which just by substituting the word Jesus become quite powerful. I will draw water out of the wells of Jesus. That's Isaiah chapter 11. That's another place. Draw water out of Jesus. It's good enough. Okay. Hinds feet, I've put a note, only occur in two other places, Psalm 18 and 2 Samuel, which are actually the same thing. And they are swift and sure and ready to leap to victory. It's all in the place where David is getting his hands ready for war, leaping over walls and doing all sorts of phenomenal jobs in order to fight and bring in the kingdom. So you've got sure and steady feet to do a bit of fighting. Oh, I notice I made a note here about the last part of Habakkuk there, chapter 3, verse 16 and 19. But of course, being on the high places with hinds feet isn't just simply a sort of supernatural, spiritual, high-powered position, but it's a place to execute judgment from. And that's why it's in the context of David's war. So I believe it's another one of those hints which is taken up in the New Testament that Jesus comes to be glorified in the saints and that the saints will judge the world. It'd be a manifestation of the sons of God that brings the world its blessing and so on, so that we shall reign with him. Okay, do you like Habakkuk?